I'd be down to either. I guess it was another one or not to.
Oh, out on the new alignment?
Yeah, to get people to slow down. They're going way too fast. And they're using an awful line on the road, but I don't think that should be a problem.
Right, so we're talking at clear out where the new overlay is.
The whole section, I've been talking out there.
Right. Yeah, and I actually, we haven't really had any conversations with ODOT since the overlays and since actually really the conclusion, the wrap-up of the new alignment construction. I know that they've had a heavy police presence there on the new alignment, and they were there for a while issuing tickets left and right. But I guess the problem actually is that the better you build roads, the faster people tend to drive. And so, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. They shortened up the route. They tried to improve everything. It's actually a safer stretch of road now because you just wider sight distance is much better. It's a much easier drive. But unfortunately, that also leads to certain people wanting to exceed the limit. And, you know, we've had kind of a series of these crossover accidents where we've had some fatalities. And I'm not really sure if that is just kind of an oddity, because that's really not has anything to do with the actual road in the areas where the collisions were. It's actually relatively straight, relatively calm stretch of road. I think those were just a couple of really bad accidents. I know in other stretches, like between Corvallis and Interstate 5, where 34 runs out to I-5, they're ODOT's looking at doing something in some of those center turn lanes to actually put dividers in. I don't believe that the stretches of Highway 20 on our end really are a good candidate for that, mostly just because it's not designed in there. There's not the width to do that. I think that the only thing that we can do as a county, and actually as City of Toledo and City of Newport and everybody else that travels Highway 20 and is actually served by Highway 20, is to, you know, make sure that we're contacting OSP. Make sure that we're contacting the Sheriff's Department and asking for, you know, due diligence as far as patrol and trying to slow people down. Because really the issue isn't so much the road, because the road's actually perfectly fine. It's the people that drive. Yeah.
Can we request more surveillance of that road?
That's always a possibility. I know as far as at the county level, when we have specific issues in specific areas of the county, we do contact the Sheriff's Department and ask them if it's possible. I mean, we don't make any demands because they have their own priorities and they have their own procedures, but we ask if it's possible to increase patrol for a period of time, you know, try to make a visual appearance there so that people know that there's law enforcement in the area. It's kind of amazing how even in places like Depot Bay and how they will park an unmarked black car somewhere, and it actually has the effect of slowing people down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just one of those things, and so appearance and presence makes a big difference. So I think, yes, we can actually call and request. That doesn't mean that you're going to see a huge increase in patrols. But they're aware of the problems, too. I mean, they're as aware or more aware than we actually are. But it doesn't hurt, you know, as a reminder. And we need to take that step and just let them know that we're concerned. And we're hoping for them to, at least for a while, see what they can do to up the trolls. And it's going to get worse as we get into the winter. Brand new asphalt, like it or not, has a lot of oil in it until it starts the season, and it's going to be a little slicker. It's a very, very nice ride. The contractor did a wonderful job out there. If you had left a few potholes, it probably would have kept people slowed down. but that's not what we do. And so they built a beautiful road, and people drive it, and they drive it for all it's worth. And unfortunately, it leads to these other incidents.
Yeah. Now, You guys complained about it for a long time because it's just whiny town. Now you're complaining because it's so good.
Dividers. Is there any way that you can put dividers like the redirection pylons at the where we had the slide on 20?
Oh, between Toledo and Newport?
Yeah. Is there any way you can put those all the way down the highway?
Actually, no. Those actually would be seen as a hazard. Well,
see, that's what I mean.
Well, I know
it keeps them from hitting them, but it made them a disaster.
You should try to plow snow with those things out in the middle of the road.
I understand, but yeah. Most people don't want to hit it.
Remember now, this is ODOT's road. His question should be going to ODOT.
Yeah.
Doug Hunt is our representative to ODOT. He would have, he could carry your message back, and we can relate to him what your views are. But county jurisdiction, that's a state highway.
But we share the same concerns.
Yeah.
You know, we're all in this together, and we share the same concerns, and we see the same thing. And I think that, you know, like I say, communication goes a long way. It's at least a step forward.
Well, we were hoping, you know, with the improvement of the road that the accidents and the fatalities would go down, but it hasn't been that way this summer. And, you know, another thing like that stretch of highway that's 34 and 20, that's east of Corvallis, that's like a special safety
corridor. Yes.
And I wonder if you would qualify, you know, a safety corridor, speed strictly enforced or something like that would make a difference.
You double the fine inside the safety corridor, right?
Right.
Introduced the first bill of that
for
the problem that was happening at the casino.
And I think ODOT designates that based on the number of accidents or fatalities. There's a numerical standard, so you can ask them to review it and see if it qualifies.
Yeah. Got to reconsider it.
Would that be something that we should go as a county then to ODOT as a unit, or just should we go on our own?
We'll first find out what the numerical standard is that they want to reach.
Maybe make notes, have Doug check into that when he gets back.
If there's a criteria
for a new safety corridor on 20, and then if there is, we can certainly make a request.
Why
didn't
you
know
more when
we
could stop it?
Yeah.
So, your background issue.
Yes. Oh, yes.
We've got him here. Let's.
As long as he's here, it says joint effort in securing the viability of the city's truck route.
Is that our fault? Because, I mean, we've been talking about this for years.
Well, I think that topic came up on the understanding that, you know, working with the county, because a good portion of the truck route is sort of it, which is County Road, and then we have a segment coming in off of across from 229 out there. But just, I think my understanding that came up as a topic, I think Councillor Dalby, I think you brought it up in regards to the possibility of just making sure that we're working cooperatively with ODOT, because that truck route is vital to, obviously, the biggest employer and the biggest taxpayer in the county.
Let me stop you here, because I just realized I did ask for introductions, and I need your introduction, too. So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, and we'll go around the table, and then we'll address the issue.
Okay.
People know who we're talking to.
Craig Martin, City Manager, City of Toledo.
You're the new one.
I'm the new one. Bill Dalby.
Councilor.
City Councilor.
Terry Strong, City Councilor. Jackie Kaufman, City Councilor.
Bill Hall, County Commissioner.
Terry Thompson, County Commissioner.
Billy Joe Smith, Mayor of Toledo.
Dion Dunlap, City Councilor.
Michelle Johnson, Councilor.
Josh Smith, City Council.
So now would you like? And Roy Kenyon is our road manager, so do you want to respond to his comments, or how would you like to deal with that?
Well, the trucks around Toledo have been an issue, and I know that you don't really like to get them on Main Street, and we get them, or we used to get them pretty much everywhere else. And it's been a work in progress. I know that we've worked with the city of Toledo from time to time to try to improve the signage. It's not perfect. I guess to start with, you know, if there seems to be an issue where they're taking a left instead of a right, we are more than willing to work with the city of Toledo to try to fix that. Before the meeting, I actually drove the route from Dairy Queen in backwards and out around Sturtevant and out to the East Junction and turned around and came back to see what was in place. It looks to me like really the signage on Highway 20 is about as good as it's probably going to be unless you start putting up flashing lights. You can only get so, you know, so well, big.
We want flashing lights.
You want flashing lights.
I want dead end streets.
Right, and I think the one of the bigger problems used to be down at 10th Street in Sturtevant, where maybe when they were either coming in or coming out, I don't know which, they'd end up clear at the very end of Sturtevant, where there really isn't a turnaround.
Yeah.
And I think that we kind of didn't fix it, and I haven't heard of that incident lately. One of the other issues is they're at Sturtevant and Business 20 down at the dip, then straightening that out and actually coming into town. And then there isn't any good left-hand turns to get them back to the mill, so they have to go down to Goodell's truck shop or something to get turned around. And so we're kind of aware of that, and if every time you get a straight truck, if you let us know... Well, you know, the thing is... One time is an accident, two times maybe, you know, maybe not so much. But if it's a consistent thing, then there's an issue at the point that they're leaving the route. And so unless we know about it, we can't address the issue.
Yeah. And so, I think, right, just so you know, we're working with Georgia Pacific. I mean, obviously they're the ones generating the truck traffic on that. And I think this topic... my understanding was put on to just make sure that we're paying attention to adequate maintenance and that we're getting adequate funding, if need be, through ODOT and others to make sure that we keep those routes in good condition.
Right.
So, because we're working with GP and quite, you know, frankly, you want, I mean, we're having a little sit down with them on Friday to talk about some, just trying to get some signage and some cohesiveness, but that I think that this topic was on in regards to, you know, can make sure that we're lobbying wherever we need to lobby, you know, for funding if we need funding to keep those routes good and passable and in good condition. I think
that truck route is one of our heaviest used roads in the county, and we understand that, and so it gets a little higher standard of maintenance than some of our others. You know, right now we do not have a lot of money to throw around, but we do set priorities, and that would be one of them. And also, you know, Sturtevant also has two school zones, so it's also there's two school zones there, and so it gets a lot of attention. There is a section currently between the elementary school and 10th Street that is a little bit on the roadside, and our intentions are sometime in the next couple of years to actually probably go in and do a grind the old asphalt out and do some base work. If we just added asphalt to the top of the existing road, we're going to lose our curb height, and then the sidewalk becomes no longer a safety zone for the children. So that all has to be reset, but that's...
Yeah.
It's kind of an expensive way to go about fixing a road, so we have to budget for that. And we, you know, we have been graced with the passage of the transportation bill at the state level, which is going to give us a little bit more than what we had. And so that's going to give us the ability to do a few more of these projects over the next 10 or 15 years. And so, yeah, we do pay attention to that. You know, I grew up in Toledo. I'm fully aware of the importance of those trucks coming in that town. We'll make sure. And like I said, you laughed, but I was serious. Don't call me. I'll give you somebody else's number. But you can call us and let us know every time we get one of those. And so if there tends to be, you know, multiple problems, then maybe we can go back and take a look at what's causing that issue at that intersection.
And we did, just so you know, just recently, for some reason, ODOT had removed the westbound signage out by the East Junction, and Public Works Director Mike Adams in contact with them. We got it back up because they were
new sign.
Yeah, because they were hitting the other, you know, route, and they're getting all
right.
messed
and
up.
And your preference is for everybody to come in the east side because you do have a length restriction on that stretch coming in town on the west side.
Yeah. So.
Basically, is signage improve the signage if possible? But the biggest problem I think that's happening is these truckers are following their GPS that, and they do not have the professional GPS that shows them the truck route.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So almost a lot of the ones that are coming to court, I was following the GPS, and it's, you know, taking them up these streets where they scrape and they can't even get up the street. The police have to come and back them up and take them out, and they're you know, it's at least every day. Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's
And that is an issue, and the bad part about that is if they're driving by GPS, either they're looking or they're listening, they're not reading.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so no matter how many signs you put up, unless you put it up in the middle of the road, and they may notice it when they run over it. You know, I don't want to make light of the situation, but it's kind of the reality, is that, you know, you really, it would be nice to work with GP to get them to somehow get their trucking companies to...
They send a map to all the trucking companies, and at the very top of the map it says, do not use GPS, and then a map. They still use the GPS. We need a GPS jamming system. They have to read the map.
Well, we will work on the little things that we can actually fix. And the rest of that, we will hope for the best.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to jump on to the other, unless you got some burning issue here with this one.
Burning issue. No,
I just want papers. Okay. Wayne Ono, I'm going to just group this whole next group of questions because they're going to all overlap. You got a chair there, Ono. You get close to a mic. I don't know where you're back.
Need another chair. Oh, one up here.
Because this is a group discussion. And there you go. Okay, what there is, I've got item B, which is housing and homelessness, and I got Bill Hall's name behind it. But then the next one is affordable housing and workforce housing, which they overlap between those. And then you got code incentives and alternative housing programs. And then item E, clarification of Lincoln County building permits and inspection procedures. So it's one group. So we've got the county experts sitting here, and any one of you is welcome to take off on your issue.
So which one do you want us to talk about?
That's up to you.
How about if I start?
This is a group discussion.
Go for it. Okay. So you're doing the building permit inspection thing?
Well, no, I'll start off with talking about the workforce housing task force report and the code incentives.
Okay.
But these all overlap. I mean,
they do it.
So that's why I want to bring it to group.
For the benefit of the new guy, could you introduce
me? I'm sorry. I'm Wayne Belmont, the county council. And I'm Ono Husing. I'm the director of the planning and building department for the county.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
And thanks for the opportunity to address these issues. So let me talk about affordable housing first. And obviously, you know, just by seeing these topics on here, I can say this up front, that these we have these discussions with every single city when we have our joint meetings. This is the topic that continues. It's the one that's across the board everywhere we go. Obviously, big issues that we're all trying to address, really trying to come to grips with, and they're very difficult issues. In terms of the workforce housing task force, you may recall that the city of Newport and the Economic Development Alliance convened, really representatives from all the communities to get together to talk about what can we do individually, what can we do together to address a number of these issues. And we met last May to talk about what might be some of the options and alternatives. And really kind of heard from each of the communities that some of the things that were unique to those communities, the issues that they faced, but really there was really much more in common than there was unique problems that we're having to face. The end result of that is that we've been sitting down. I know that the group that I meet monthly with the group of city managers, Craig Martin is part of that group that meets, and this is on our agenda every single month. We talk about what we can do, the kinds of things that we can bring to the table to try and help. And the different groups of planners, some of the folks that are involved from public works side, those kinds of things, have been meeting to talk about the things that we can do. And I just learned, actually this week, from the city manager in Newport that they're going to reconvene this group, the task force, to report on exactly what's been done to date. In October. He wouldn't give me a firm date, but he did say, you can tell everybody we're going to meet in October. So he'll be getting an invitation to send along representatives to this particular meeting in October. That really kind of segues into some of the specific things that have been done, the code incentives. Newport has really kind of led the charge in this particular area, and they actually adopted a series of four different measures that they're trying to approach housing issues. First thing that they learned was that the development community, many of them were saying, your system's development charges are pricing us out of the market. I mean, they're not the only factor. Obviously, the availability of developable property is a key function, but they were saying that those SDCs were causing a number of problems. So the city actually undertook a very, very detailed examination of their SDCs, but they didn't do it in a vacuum. They actually looked at it because the legislature has authorized the development of a construction excise tax in which the proceeds can be placed in a fund to actually help with affordable housing kinds of issues. And so they decided to look at those two things in concert. And what they ended up doing is they made some modifications, some selective modifications to their SDCs and lowered those, but they instituted a construction excise tax. And they're going to collect that particular money and use that for affordable housing programs. I think the biggest issue they faced, and the most difficult one for their city council and the mayor to look at, was, all right, we've put this in place, now what do we use the money for? And I think they sort of came to the conclusion there's a lot of different ideas and alternatives, and we don't want to really paint ourselves into a corner with saying we're going to spend it on X, Y, or Z. So they said, we're going to create the fund first, we're going to create some of the money, and then we're going to explore with the development community how can we actually best spend this money. So that was the way that they approached it, and they did those two things in concert. They did two other code incentive activities, and they've actually asked the county to participate with them. And I should say that the county's role in a lot of this stuff, just the way the whole system works, is that the county actually tries to discourage development in rural areas. Our role under statewide planning goals and through our local plan is to actually protect resource lands. We're more involved with that than we are in encouraging development necessarily out there. In fact, the statewide system encourages denser development inside of urban growth boundaries and in cities. And that's the way that the state tries to address the housing situation, by making incentives for more development in more concentrated areas to get infrastructure, to get transportation, to do those kinds of things. So they're asking us to assist them in a couple of programs that will encourage two things. One will encourage nonprofit low-income housing projects, and there's a number of these that are authorized by state law. And the second would be to encourage multifamily development. And this multifamily development has several different elements to it. One is that they want to ensure that the multifamily development is not used for vacation rental dwellings, so it prohibits that. They want to ensure that a portion of the housing it is provided is affordable housing, and there's a definition by law of what that means. It uses some HUD standards. They want the development to include elements of what they call green development, really energy-efficient housing. And then the fourth element that they have is that it has to be located in proximity to transportation corridors. And they've got those mapped out with our public transit system. So they've actually adopted these two ordinances. And the way that they work is there's either a full or partial property tax exemption for qualifying properties. They come in and meet, and it's a very rigorous set of requirements, and I'd be happy, I'll share with Craig if he doesn't have it already, and he can share with you. the actual codes that they've put together. And the reason why they want the county in here is the way it works under state law is if the city would partner with the county and the combination of the two entities together exceeds 51% of the taxing authority for the area, then the entire property tax is exempted for the property. That's the way the system works. So it can work well when they can actually just partner with the county alone, even though they would contact, and they do contact, other taxing agencies that are out there. But the combination of the two gives a full exemption for the properties. The county has done this actually in the past on specific projects. We've done some multifamily housing in Lincoln City, and we've done some multifamily housing in Walpole. So we've kind of targeted specific housing. They want to make it broader. They've actually targeted and identified specific zones, specific areas within their communities for both of these kinds of projects, and really want to provide these kinds of incentives. So they put that out there. At this point, it's really hard to say. You know, the state law, at least in the nonprofit housing, has been out there for years. And sometimes it's enough of an incentive to bring in development. But, you know, again, we've only had two projects that have actually gone to fruition. But that's something that they want to explore. And we're going to be bringing that in front of the Board of Commissioners in the next month for consideration of adopting our portions of the exemption part of this thing to partner with them on those projects. I don't have as good an update of Lincoln City, although they've been very busy. And Lincoln City has a little bit different approach in what they're doing that's really predicated on the fact that they actually have purchased some property. They own an entire development in the north part of the county that gives them some options for doing all kinds of things in terms of how that property will actually eventually develop, providing some incentives to developers to come in and provide a project that may provide a percentage of the housing as affordable housing, again, defined by the city. So they've got some different ways that they're approaching it. Walport's also doing some different things. But we'll learn more about all those things related to affordable housing when we reconvene in October, and I'd really encourage the city to bring representatives to that meeting. So that's what I have to offer.
Any questions of Wayne or Ono, who's our planning department? You're welcome. Address any of these issues, they're the experts.
I just have one little minor question. This is great. I appreciate your report. That's clarified a lot of things for me. The use for the affordable housing programs, they've got money for affordable housing, the city. If it had money for affordable housing, then they're going to explore it with the development community.
I think
that who's the development community? Because we don't really have a connection with the development.
Well, it's those who are interested in accessing the program. So what they're going to do is they're going to talk to a variety of people out there to say, you know, all right, we've got the money. What would be the best thing for us to do? Should we spend money, for instance, on subsidizing, let's say, infrastructure to a specific area? So we'll agree to provide sewer, water, amenities to make a shovel-ready development out here. Now, you as a developer, will you come in and develop this property?
That's developers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it would be working on specific kinds of projects, that kind of stuff. You know, there's different ways they can do it. I will say this, that my understanding is that Newport has really looked to the city of Bend, which I think has been the leader for small communities in the state, for actually coming up with ways to actually incentivize, you know, the development out there. So I'm not an expert in any means on what they're going to do with the money, what they're going to end up doing. I know that was an issue for them, and they decided not to decide that now, but rather to gather the funds, the war chest, to actually say, now we can approach some solutions to the problem.
So, do you view tiny housing as a feasible approach to increasing affordable housing?
That's a good question, you know, and it depends on your definition of tiny housing. You know, right now, current building codes allow you to develop a pretty small structure, you know, meaning of things. So, you know, really I don't have to do anything different to develop a small house. Not a tiny house, I think, as you're describing it, probably is the ones that don't meet current code requirements.
Right.
You know, there are a different set of code requirements. And we're watching with interest as others kind of get into the development of that. I can't say right now. Probably a better question for Honor.
I know, didn't a bill pass in the legislature, Phil Barnhart's bill, to make tiny houses essentially something that would be an outright approval in most parts of the state or all?
Well, I'm not, Commissioner Hall, and thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. I'm not aware that, I just stop and say, at the risk of alienating people here who might like tiny houses, that to me, tiny houses is a fad. And it's a term that, if I had a buck for every time someone talked to us over the counter or on the phone, is, I want to do a tiny house. And these things are being produced in these small factory type things or in shops, and they're going out there on wheels, and many of them are not built to code. I mean, they're really dangerous, and of course they're a response to this systemic national problem about having affordable housing, and some of these things can actually be quite expensive, but. What we tell people when they come in and ask the question, we do get the question frequently, is show us a set of plans that meet Oregon building codes, because we're obligated in our planning department, and so is the city of Toledo, of course, to have plans and build to codes. And the codes are grounded in things blowing up and burning down and all, you know, they're not sitting in an office somewhere saying, gee, I think I'll make it difficult and more expensive to do development. I mean, it's the underwriter laboratory and the development community. We know the kinds of things when you don't have codes and you build in a slipshod way, things fall down and blow up and burn down and all that. So we just tell people, show us a set of plans, build the codes. But, you know, and our building inspector, Al Leams, is actually the best person to walk people through exactly what they should do. But you can really build a very small stick-built home, and as long as it has a toilet and a sink and a certain clearance here and there, I mean, these things can be really quite small.
The square footage,
there's no minimum square footage.
I think there is a minimum square footage.
Well, you've got to have, there's some minimum features that,
right,
to be able to issue a certificate of occupancy. So there is no set formula, like it's got to be, you know, over 500 square feet or something. And that's why it's a real simple, straightforward discussion with people. Bring us a set of plans. We will look at them like we look at any, even some mansion someone wants to build, with the same eyeballs of it's got to be built right. It's got to meet Oregon State building codes.
So today,
sure,
you would issue a permit for tiny house if you felt that the plans indicated that it was built to code.
Indeed, we would be obligated to. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. If the zoning's right, if you got the septic, or if you have sewer, sure. But a lot of these things don't, and so we're always telling people on the phone or over the counter, for God's sakes, don't go buy something and then come talk to us about this, because that's what's really tragic, is they've thrown $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 at something. And then now they don't know where to put it. And it's kind of, you know, and that's why we're dealing, you know, let's face it, the other major thing that people do to try to have affordable housing is they're living in recreational vehicles. And there's an epidemic of them and makeshift RV parks. But if I can share my central observation about the affordable housing, this problem has to be addressed in Oregon by the cities. Because you have and Wayne talked about this, I think, quite clearly. We are tasked in Oregon. What makes us the greatest assets we have in Lincoln County and all the 36 counties in Oregon is we have a strong land use system that channels most of the growth. They don't want sprawl. The reason people are coming here and they look around and they say, "Wow, this looks like the place that I grew up in 50, 60 years ago." Wow, that's not by accident. We have to say no constantly to people that just want their 5 acres here or just want the house there or just want this or just want that. The drumbeat, in the 5 years that I've been the director of the department, the drumbeat of development, day in, day out, if we didn't have a strict land use system in place, this place would look like hell. And it would have looked like hell a long time ago. And so, way back when, yeah, and thank God it happened when it happened before the full rush occurred. It was very far-sighted. The system's been tested legally and otherwise. And, you know, the calls that we get every day are, you know, they're not, "You're regulating me." There's some people that believe they're being regulated too much. Of course they believe that. But the the lion's share of the people that call us and complain are filling out, are trying to get us to enforce our codes more rigorously because their neighbors are doing things and the people not getting permits, doing dangerous things out there, doing thoughtless things that impact their neighbors in a terrible way. We just can't keep up with the code enforcement. I know that's something we're going to talk about here in a minute. So we share your concerns that I know Commissioner Thompson has taken a special interest in making sure that we have an all hands on deck in our county right now, serious discussions about what do we do about code enforcement. And it may be a part of the problem is the housing shortage because people are just doing things but you know, people need to get their permits, and really, there are very few advantages to going out there and building things without permits. There, it ends up being dangerous, and you try to sell the place. Thank God the banks are asking questions; they want to make sure that the proper paperwork is there. I mean, this is what separates us from a banana republic. And so, when you buy a house in Lincoln County and in America, most places in America, you can be pretty sure that there was a set of plans that met building codes, and there was an inspector out there who wasn't on the take, actually making sure that it's a safe house, and so we work overtime to try to enforce those laws. But back to the central point that I want to make. Thank you, Commissioner Thompson. Is we've got to really target some places within cities that have urban services to them where we can get the densities going, whether they're apartment complexes or maybe even more modern RV parks that are adequately run and subsidized so that they're not just old fish camps that have turned into something else. I believe in Habitat for Humanity, but if you're going to do these things one at a time, we're never going to make a dent in this problem. We've got to be aggressive. And that means the burden is on people in this room, especially in the cities, to make those tough calls about running that sewer line out somewhere where we can create apartments and these kinds of things to really begin attacking this problem with some scale and creating these things. And yes, there's a role for subsidy in that. Thank you, Commissioner Thompson, for your...
Let me give Bill a chance here, because mixed in this whole issue is homeless housing.
I have a question concerning permits and so forth. I submitted a set of plans on August 8th for a deck. It's a simple deck. I've been building for 55 years and drawing plans for that long.
To our department?
To your department.
Okay.
And I still don't have a permit. And it seems like it takes so long for a simple little deck. Why?
Well, right now we're short-staffed. I'm not trying to make excuses. I'm just trying to explain, all right?
Uh-huh.
And it's my understanding compared to, you know, people come and deal with, and I'm very proud of what we do at our department and the kind of, we work our tails off. And we've got a huge amount of development pressure on us right now. We're looking to hire another planner, but that's a building permit issue. It's not even a planning issue. It's my understanding, professional developers tell us all the time that we're a dream to work with, that we process permits far quicker. We've had developers come into our department and say, your permits are too low. I work all over the state.
I got to cut this off. This is a conversation between the city and the county. On your particular issue, if you address it in our meeting after this, you can address it under public comment.
I'll be happy to get your name and check on the permit and get your call back on the state.
They gave me a permit, but they gave me a permit number, but they said it's hung up somewhere. That's always been the answer for like 2 weeks. It's hung up somewhere.
Well, you're welcome to...
I just go, it's a deck, it's not a house.
I got to cut this off because this is our...
Be pleased to look into it.
We'll be glad to look into it, but... We're under a different set of protocols here between
Appreciate
the city.
It, thanks.
Sure, sure.
We'll be glad to work with her. If you have problems, you're welcome to call the commissioners, and we'll talk to him. Okay, back to city council.
The thing was clarification of county building permit and inspection procedures. Yeah. Who had that on the agenda, and what was the question?
The thing was is that we have a lot of people we have people that come to us that are concerned that when they submit for permits and things that our codes aren't being looked at, but it's more of a general what you guys are looking at. They're saying, well, they told me I didn't have to do that. And that's what we're getting, is we're getting feedback from individuals. And when they go in and submit a permit, they've come in and said, well, is it, oh, don't worry about what the city says. You follow what we say. And this isn't just one occurrence, two occurrences. We get the feeling like, and we are, we're off to the side over here. We're a small community. And the attitude about Toledo sucks. That's all there is to it. I'm going to say it. I don't know how that goes towards county, that part of it. I feel like we're, you know, well, they're just a small little community. Don't worry about what they say. I'm just wondering, what do we need a better communication? Are we, how is our...
I'm going to take a shot at that. I appreciate that information. And actually, I had an opportunity, since I saw that was the subject matter, to talk to your city manager a little bit, too.
Okay.
We actually have an intergovernmental agreement with the city to cover these particular services. And it actually demarcates very clearly, you know, responsibilities. So, for instance, if somebody's coming in and saying city code issues, well, actually, the way the permit process works, it's the city who actually has to sign off on those things and has to say yes, no, or otherwise. So if there may be some communication issues Craig and I talked about, we'll get together with the, with the building official, with Mr. Husing, and try and see and make sure that that communication is occurring properly. But I think just in answer to your question, it's really clear within the MOU as to the responsibilities of the various parties. And I think we just need to make sure everybody's doing it. So we can do that.
I run into the same problem all the time. People come to me, and I find out that the piece of property sits inside of Newport or inside of that, and it's not necessarily the county's issue, unless in certain cases it is. So, first of all, you got to find out exactly whose jurisdiction it is and who's in charge.
Yeah.
And I just, in fact, I ran into it just 5 minutes before I walked in here and didn't understand exactly who he was supposed to be talking to, because governments overlap.
Right. And I think people that go in there will misunderstand. They're gonna go by what you guys, because they're going over to you, submitting the plans, da 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 da, and then we get an inspection out, you know, and really it cuts off the city as far as us coming in here and dealing, because it's all out there. The inspector comes from the county, not from the city, and then we hear things where I don't.
Well, I didn't have to do that,
you know. So I'm just saying, I want to make sure that we have a good rapport with each other, because
sure.
I don't want to be the stepchild in the back seat.
No,
that,
I agree.
You know, so I just want to make sure that we're not doing something wrong.
We got a good roadmap. We just got to make sure we're driving down that road.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. Yeah. I appreciate seeing getting a copy of the services agreement with our agenda. That helped me. I read it as quickly as possible. But it does say, in coordination and responsibilities, that the county shall not issue any permit unless and until it has been approved by the city as conforming to applicable city regulations, ordinances, and requirements. And we've had people come to our council meetings and say, well, the county told us that we just need to go to them and that the city doesn't matter. And so that's why we want that communication between our planning and our approval to be a little bit better.
Well,
okay, that's it. That's why we did this. Yeah.
So, the homeless issue. Bill, you're the expert on the homeless side.
Okay. Well, it is increasing here. It is increasing, I think, just about everywhere in the state and in the country. One of the things that I was part of a lobby group in the legislature, you know, sometimes you take two steps forward, one step back. In the last legislative session that did budget 2 years ago, they did a one-time, they made it very clear it was going to be a one-time doubling of emergency housing and shelter funds for the homeless, and that was going to go away this year. But despite the fact that the state was in a dire budget situation, we managed to get them to keep that money at the same level. So we didn't gain any ground, but we didn't lose ground. And what these funds are is local agencies, like in Lincoln County, it's Community Services Consortium. Say they're trying to help a homeless family, and maybe they've been able, through Section 8 or other rent assistance, get them lined up for a permanent housing, but that's not going to be available for 2 weeks, and they're going to put them up in an apartment for 2 weeks, say, I mean, in a motel for 2 weeks. This is the pot of money they used to do that, so at least we kept that whole instead of having it cut like the governor's budget originally proposed. You know, we've had severe weather shelters operating in the winter in both Newport for several years, more recently a couple of them in Lincoln City. There are two nonprofit groups at work, one in each community, that are trying to get permanent shelters going. The Lincoln City one has gotten some real momentum, I think. They're going to operate all this winter out of the old Taft Fire Station, but they've gotten a $50,000 grant from the City of Lincoln City and also a private donation of a 3,000-square-foot disassembled metal building that they are now looking for a site to set it up permanently. But it's a challenge. I mean, nationally, they say for families that qualify as low income or very low income, there's 31 housing units for every 100 families. So, you know, it's a deficit that is built up really over perhaps 40 years. And we're starting to make a little bit of headway, but it's not nearly close to what it needs to be.
So what do we say to someone who's homeless in Toledo? Who do we refer them to? What do we do?
Well, it depends on if it's a single person or a family. If it's a family, I would suggest encouraging them to contact Samaritan House. If it's a single person, you know, you could probably Samaritan House and then Community Services Consortium are the best kind of clearing houses for service. Even if they can't help them directly, hopefully they can refer them to other resources.
And a lot of these people, for various reasons, not a lot, but some, have some mental problems. And when you don't give them a straightforward, simple answer, they have trouble getting through the system. And then it becomes a problem sometimes and winds up, can be in our jails and add to the problem there.
I mean, there's so many contributing factors. I mean, domestic violence, a lot of people don't realize, but I think national studies say it's the fourth leading cause of homelessness. You know, a lot of times people say, well, why don't women flee abusive situations? And in a lot of cases, it's because they know they're going to end up homeless. Mental illness, addictions, physical health, loss of job, you know, inadequate income. I remember talking to a woman who was working two part-time jobs a couple of years ago, but still, you know, she even said if she could find a $600 a month apartment, she could probably live, but she could never save up the, you know, $1,500 or more that would be needed for the upfront move-in costs, so she was sleeping in her car.
Is there funds for people to have, like, their first house? That's my thing, is that we talk about, you know, the housing and stuff, the affordable housing. I don't know where there's anything affordable, period, unless you get some piece of crap that's about ready to fall down. I mean, rent is through the roof. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a supply and demand
and
thing.
I know, but
sure.
I mean, my God, is there no way to, I mean, can you try that?
Well,
it's just sad because they're sending out all the people that do maybe the lower income jobs, but then there's nowhere there for them to live. Is there a way for us? I mean, are they looking into maybe doing some kind of dormitory type buildings where we could actually have a centrally located kitchen where they all have their own room, but yet they have community areas and stuff?
You know,
and
we've tried that in the past sometimes. HUD was a program that did a lot of that, and it turned out to be pretty much a failure on that type of thing.
Well, the big multi-story buildings in the urban areas. But again, getting back to tiny houses, you know, this is an interesting thing in Toledo I've been following. Square One Villages, they set up, sort of like Dignity Village in Portland, shacks without utilities, just sleeping shacks, and then a central shower facility and cooking facility. Well, they've taken it to a next step where they're doing full tiny houses designed for permanent occupancy that meet code.
That's better. Hmm? That's
better. Yeah, I mean, for long-term folks. And I talked to them, they said, you know, not only did they get far more applications than for the initial 30 houses, but what really surprised them is that half the applicants were over 60, because, you know, there's an advocate for the homeless I know in Portland. He said the next big wave we're going to be seeing is a lot of senior homeless.
I've been telling you.
Oh, yeah.
When they get older, what are we going to do with them?
Oh, yeah.
What's going to happen with this generation?
I found an article online not too long ago. 80-year-old woman in the Southwest who's living out of her car. She didn't have any children. She was widowed. She thought she was doing a smart thing with her inheritance and insurance money. This was about 2006, by buying two homes, one to live in and one for rental income. Well, you know, the housing bubble burst. She was underwater and in her mortgages, ended up losing both houses, and is now living in her car, an 80-year-old woman.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, here's one of the problems is you have a strong economy. The value of housing goes up in a strong economy.
So how do you build affordable homes? I mean, we need to lower our square footage down. We have too high of our square footage, I think. I think we can drop it down to an apartment-sized little cottage where they're all, and then maybe they have a
city,
common backyard or something where they have it. But that's the thing.
Well, either you've got to incentivize private developers for profit or non-profit developers. You know, I know a county commissioner in Washington County where somebody was putting in a 1,400-unit project because, you know, Washington County is growing by leaps and bounds. He was doing 2,000 square foot attached row houses and 3,000 square foot single family houses. And this commissioner sat down with the developer and said, you know, I've looked at your paperwork, your pro formas here. What if you did some 1,000 square foot homes as, you know, either starter homes or empty nester homes? And the developer just basically said, I can make more money with this plan, so I'm going to do it.
Right.
So unless you either find a way to subsidize a private developer to make it worth his while, or you can get a nonprofit to do it.
So what are some of the nonprofits that I know? One time, a while back, there was someone that came down, like
the Community Land Trust.
Hopefully, is that what she was with? Community Land Trust.
Yep. We've only done a couple of homes up in Lincoln City, but we're hoping the cities of Newport, Lincoln City, and the county have put money into that program for the last few years. And for administration, and we haven't used all the administration money, so we've got an agreement from the county and the two cities to free some of that money up for homes. And then also the legislature this year did do another round of housing bonds, what they call the LIFT program, Low Income Fast Track. And some of that money in this year is going to be made available for single-family homes. So we're hoping we might be able to access that to get at least a few homes going.
So that's state money.
Yeah, yeah. Bonding against future lottery revenues, and it's administered by Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Because I'm thinking, you know, if there was a city property that where we could put, and I don't want tiny houses on wheels. I'm thinking of what you were talking about. A small cottage, a small home that has plumbing and has heat and has a little, you know, place where you
maybe
can
if it's
have a sink.
300, 400 square feet.
Built to code.
Yeah.
Built to code. I know I've heard that like bathroom size code is maybe too big and they're using a different size code for that, like what a trailer would have, you know, what a manufactured home code would be. But something like that.
Yeah. The other organization to talk to would be Northwest Coastal Housing. It used to be the Community Development Corporation, but their big project is the Ridge in Lincoln City, but which is like 88 units that they developed about 20 years ago.
They just actually refurbished or
rehabilitating, but they're interested in development opportunities as well. So, like if the city had a parcel to offer up, you know, those are two local nonprofits that
would
be worth at least talking to.
Yeah.
And often provided that urban service, that sewer line to that property, and then...
Like, I'm in a developer in Hood River, a private developer who for the last 20 years has concentrated on affordable housing, and he says he delivers houses at about $250,000 each, which, since the average housing price in Hood River is now $400,000, he considers affordable. But, among other things, you know, he's made a commitment. He said he wanted his kids and his grandkids to be able to afford to live in Hood River. He makes no profit on his land. He relies on volume. If, he says if he didn't do 20, 25 houses a year, he wouldn't make it. And also, he's got enough cash flow that he doesn't have to deal with banks. He basically self-finances. But unless you've got somebody, you know, who's really committed to their community, willing to look at a model like that, you need, somebody's going to have to provide outside incentives, and that's usually going to be a local or state government.
Let me interrupt this because we got about 4 minutes.
And we need to.
I want to touch, as we address codes, Wayne, you want to talk about the changes in code that we're talking about, you know, debris and things like that? Because
code enforcement.
Code enforcement.
Yeah, we're looking at, and actually funding a position or a part of a position to do code enforcement activities.
Yeah, we need to do that.
You know, if you look at sister communities around Lincoln County, at times some communities have had code enforcement officers and they go away for budgetary reasons and they come back and doing that. But we're looking at doing that and looking at some streamlined procedures in order to make the process a little bit easier to do. And like everything else, it all depends on getting the funding together. We've put together kind of the decision. We think having a person focused on that, right now the activities take place pretty much within our departments. So it's somebody who's has many other duties and responsibilities who does a little code enforcement on the side. So having somebody who can actually do that and focus kind of exclusively on that will go a long ways. And we hope to actually get that up and running in the not-too-distant future.
Now that's on county. We're not coming in and doing cities for it.
Well, I'm thinking of a lot of places I've seen on the county that I was wishing you would do that. So that's real spine.
Well, through our contractual responsibilities, actually, Commissioner Thompson, with those resources, I think it could be a contributing factor. And it's all about getting the right kind of person in there who really is skilled in this. Mm-hmm. And because maybe the reason your deck hasn't been processed is there's so many red files on my desk, and that red file is a code enforcement thing, and each of these things can take an enormous amount of time and energy. If someone doesn't want to comply, and I'm a civil libertarian, everybody has to have their day in court, but the streamlined process that Wayne was talking about also needs to happen. People can really, you know, a handful of people can drag you through the mud on this stuff, and it goes on, and that's not fair to everybody else.
No, this is
about
city.
Code enforcement, though.
Yeah, but this is about the conversation between city and county. In the next meeting, you're welcome to address it. So we're not going to be cowboys in this. I mean, it's not going to ride over the horizon, and all of a sudden we're going to clean up the county. It's just this is a long process. I mean, to try to get the people to clean up the property, and if they don't, then we go to our lawyers. Don't think that having a code enforcement officer is all of a sudden going to clean up the West. It isn't. It doesn't happen that way. But it's a step forward. Okay. So it's 7:00. We usually try to end it on time.